Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump begins today in the U.S. Senate. He's accused of inciting his supporters to storm the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, the day that Congress was meeting to certify the election results for Joe Biden. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke this morning about the trial.
I believe the managers will present a very strong case. The evidence will be powerful. The evidence, some of it will be new.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us now from the Senate with the latest. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
So, Claudia, the prevailing thought going into this trial is that Democrats don't have the votes to convict Trump. So what do both sides hope to achieve as this trial unfolds?
I listened to a call with senior aides to the House impeachment managers today, and they said Democrats still remain optimistic that they will present a case that will connect with the hearts and minds of these 100 jurors, some of whom may not be planning to vote to convict the president, the former president at this time. That said, one of these aides admitted it is possible that tribalism and loyalty to Trump could overtake good judgment. But this aide also followed up with their plans to put on a, quote, devastating case against Trump. These aides said this is personal for them. They experienced the attack. This is a serious and solemn duty for these managers. And there's no doubt that they are focused on Trump's role. They see him as being singularly responsible for this attack on the Capitol. So they'll tell a story of beginning, middle, and end to how we ended up seeing this deadly attack on January 6th. The House impeachment managers also plan to be succinct and to the point, non-repetitive. The attack happened in plain sight. It's in video. And they plan to use all the evidence available to them in all forms. This includes evidence we haven't seen before, but they would not elaborate what that means. They also said it's not about politics. It's about this very serious issue of holding President Trump, former President Trump, accountable. Now, when it comes to Republicans, the party's being faced with a loyalty test at one end, whether they remain loyal to Trump or a minority of members who may vote to convict the president and hold him accountable.
Okay, so one big thing on today's agenda is that senators will be debating whether it's constitutional to convict the now former president. The Constitution is not explicit on this. What do we expect to hear specifically about this?
Democrats expect to present a case that he can be convicted. They say even Republican legal experts say that he can be, noting that the period of elections and peaceful transfer of power are a source of national pride, and there is no, quote, January exception to impeachment, as a president must answer comprehensively for his conduct in office from his first day to his last.
Okay, you alluded to this, but Trump's lawyers are claiming that he was protected by the First Amendment free speech rights when he told supporters that the election was stolen and that they should march on the Capitol. Why do Democrats think that's not true, that the First Amendment does not apply here?
They say his language was quite literal when he was telling his followers to, quote, fight and expect a, quote, wild rally. And House impeachment managers say there's a pattern that was established here in the weeks and months leading up to the insurrection. And they say in many ways Trump incited this siege in that period before the insurrection. One example we heard from Georgia officials when they said that someone is going to get killed because of Trump's dangerous rhetoric. Another when Trump has endorsed past violence, such as when his supporters chased and surrounded a Democratic campaign bus on a central Texas highway.
What else will you be watching for in this trial?
I'll be watching Republicans, more specifically the moderate Republican senators who may vote to convict the president. When we saw a vote last month on the constitutionality of the trial, this was an initial test of where all the members were. We saw five Republican members break with their party to say that the trial is indeed constitutional. They were Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska. Those were the five that broke with their party to vote to say this trial is constitutional. So I'll be curious if they vote along these lines again today, and if they later vote to convict the president. I'll also be interested to see other Republicans who did not vote for the constitutionality question the first time around, if they've had a change of mind, perhaps by today or by the trial's end. For a conviction, two-thirds of the chamber will need to vote to convict the former president, so Democrats will need 17 Republicans to join them, and right now that appears to be very unlikely.
And really quickly, how long do you expect this trial to last?
Everyone seems to be on the same page. They want to get through this as quickly as possible, so at least in shorter fashion than the three-week Senate impeachment trial we saw last year, it could be a couple weeks or less.
Claudia Grisales is NPR congressional reporter. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Let's take a closer look now at former President Trump's legal team and its strategy with Washington Post reporter Rosalind Helderman. Hey, Roz.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. So the former president's legal team now includes attorney David Schoen and Bruce Castor Jr. Let's start with Schoen. What should people know about him?
Sure. Well, neither of these figures are well-known people in the legal community. Neither of them are known to be serious constitutional scholars, but both of them have spent quite a bit of time in a courtroom. David Schoen is an Atlanta-based lawyer. He's a criminal defense attorney. He has bragged about the number of sort of big-name mobsters that he has represented in the past. He had this somewhat well-known, because he talks about it a lot, meeting with Jeffrey Epstein at the Manhattan jail days before Mr. Epstein took his own life when he was under a federal indictment. So he's a guy who spent time in a courtroom. And, you know, when you're arguing a case, that could be helpful in the coming days.
And what about Bruce Castor Jr.? We know that he's the cousin of Steve Castor, so the last name may be familiar. Steve Castor was the House Minority Counsel who defended then-President Trump during the first impeachment trial. But tell us more about Bruce Castor Jr.
Sure. Bruce Castor might be familiar to some people in Pennsylvania. He was a fairly well-known local prosecutor in Pennsylvania. He was a district attorney, the kind of district attorney who got a lot of local news coverage, was on TV quite a bit for the cases he was handling, known as a big personality, but also known probably the thing he is best known for is that as district attorney, he made a decision not to prosecute the comedian and actor Bill Cosby when allegations of sexual misconduct began to emerge about him. Mr. Cosby, of course, was later prosecuted essentially by one of Bruce Castor's successors and is now serving a prison sentence.
I see. And so Castor and Schoen are coming in after the departure of the former president's original defense team. And Roz, you report that had to do with the legal argument that Trump was pushing for. He wanted to emphasize his false claim of election fraud. Can you explain what happened there?
Sure. He had this team of five sort of low-key, fairly locally well-respected lawyers from South Carolina who he had located through Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator. Our understanding is there was something of a falling out about legal strategy because it was very important to the president to press, to continue to press in this trial, his false argument that the election was stolen from him. Now, I will say that that has been denied by some people in the president's camp, although that's what our reporting shows. Both of his new attorneys, Schoen and Castor, have said that they do not intend for his arguments about the election to be a central part of what they argue. What they have said in their legal brief so far is simply that his arguments on that point are protected by the First Amendment. They did have some convoluted language essentially arguing that you can't prove his claims were false, and hence he should have been allowed to make them.
Well, so there's the First Amendment argument, and then there's also the question of whether the trial is constitutional in the first place. And I'm curious about that point, Ross, because, I mean, Trump insists that he won the election, but one of the key defenses of this revamped legal team appears to be that he lost the election and therefore can't be put on trial because he's no longer president. So based on your reporting, how does Trump feel about this argument, which is kind of a concession?
Yeah, it's an interesting central conundrum. You know, when they first filed their first legal document last week, I noticed that nowhere in the document did they refer to Donald Trump as being the former president, even though their entire legal argument is predicated on the idea that you cannot try a former president. Instead, they referred to him throughout as the 45th president, I guess to distinguish him from Joe Biden, who is the 46th president. That said, they filed a brief earlier this week where they did use the language former president. I think they have sort of settled amongst them that because this is their core argument, they're going to have to acknowledge that he isn't now at this point no longer president of the United States.
And Roz, we know that Democrats are going to fixate on what then-President Trump told his supporters on the day of the insurrection. He said, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. How is Trump's defense team going to explain that and defend that?
Yeah, they're going to want to talk very exclusively about the speech that he made that day. They're going to look closely at the language. They're going to look at that fight language and say essentially that that's common political rhetoric. They're going to cite instances in which Democrats have used that kind of language as well. The Democrats are going to argue, look at the whole course of conduct. You have to look at that speech in context. It was inciting to the crowd.
I see. So taking a narrow view there and maybe a little bit of whataboutism as well. Roslyn Helderman, reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Negotiations over a coronavirus relief package have been central to President Biden's first weeks in office, but he's also confronting a long list of foreign policy challenges, global vaccine distribution, trade, and the task of repairing alliances that were frayed by former President Donald Trump. In his first major foreign policy speech as president last week, Biden laid out his vision.
America is back. Diplomacy is back at the center of our foreign policy. As I said in my inaugural address, we will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again, not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's.
We want to get some reaction now to how Biden's foreign policy is shaping up in Europe. And for that, we're joined on Skype by Rosa Balfour, director of the Europe Center at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome, Rosa.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. And so the president outlined a few immediate changes in his announcement last week, including a nuclear arms treaty with Russia and the decision to keep U.S. troops in Germany that former President Trump had said would be coming back to the U.S. So how was his address and this statement that America is back received in Europe?
Everything that has happened since Biden was elected has been well received in Europe. There is an overwhelming delight that things have changed in the White House, and all of the decisions that were actually taken in the first few days of the Biden administration are also welcome in Europe. However, there still are some issues Europeans are worried about. And I think one of them is that while the Biden administration really wants to invest on allies and on diplomacy, which is music to the ears of Europeans, at the same time, there is a bit of a concern that the priorities of the new administration will be very much domestically focused, and that that will have implications for trade, for climate change priorities, technology. So it does raise some potentially troubling issues in the relationship between the U.S. and Europe together.
Well, let me ask you about one of those then, Rosa, because one of the early executive actions that President Biden took was signing his so-called Buy American executive order. So you mentioned trade as a potential issue. Does Europe look at that as a form of protectionism?
Well, there are suspicions that that is what the deeper meaning of this decision actually is. And Europe would probably be more ambitious than the US in seeking a broader trade deal. So I would be cautiously optimistic that Europeans and Americans can go through their differences, but there are suspicions in Europe about the US's ultimate goal in terms of trade policy.
Could any concerns about protectionism also extend to access to a coronavirus vaccine? Because so far the supply has been kind of limited. Could there be some tension between the US and Europe about who is able to get their hands on these limited supplies?
Yes. So there's been a bit of a spat with the UK over procurement of coronavirus vaccines, and these could well continue. Having said this, There is a general commitment that this coronavirus pandemic really needs to be addressed through global cooperation, and European leaders have been underlining this. And so I think ultimately this line will prevail, but it is marred because of the panic and the desperation attached to wanting to end this pandemic and get back onto a normal footing in our lives, in the economy, and globally.
Well, on that idea of getting back to a sort of a normal footing, we heard Germany's foreign minister say that he hopes for a reset of U.S.-European relations under the Biden administration. I'm wondering, Rosa, how easily you think the new president can do that. I mean, is there any lingering concern in Europe that the U.S. is just not as reliable as it once was based on the last 4 years?
Yes, I'm afraid the legacy of 4 years of Trump is pretty dramatic. He's cast a long shadow, and there are doubts. We've seen this before. George W. Bush was not loved at all in Europe, and then America bounced back with Obama. With Biden, it might take a little longer, but I think all the ingredients are there. At the end of the day, even if Europe and the US do not align on everything, they don't align necessarily on their view of the Chinese threat or the Russian threat, but they are far closer to each other than they are to anyone else.
And I'm glad you brought up Russia, because that was one of the things that the president brought up in his speech last week. He criticized what he calls the, quote, determination of Russia to damage and disrupt our democracy. He also sort of reaffirmed the United States commitment to NATO, calling it one of the country's closest friends. How is Biden's Russia policy taking shape, and what does that mean for NATO in your view?
So let's just premise this, because Europe has just had a bit of a diplomatic blunder with Russia. The High Representative for Foreign Affairs visited Moscow, and the outcome of the visit was very negative. But the High Representative has also said, there's only so much I can do if the member states continue to be divided. And this is the big issue in Europe with respect to Russia in particular, but also with respect to China, is that the member states are quite simply not on the same page. I think Biden, if he works with his allies in Europe carefully and is in a listening mode in doing so, can help bring Europeans closer together. And this affects EU-US cooperation on Russia, but also NATO and Russia. And we know that NATO has, you know, still considers Russia as the greatest threat. And of course, the US decision to wait before moving troops out of Germany is only welcome in Germany. Trump's earlier decision to move them out was viewed very negatively in Germany.
Rosa Balfour directs the Europe Center at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Rosa, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
A warning that our next story focuses on a disturbing issue. Thousands of victims of incest in France are coming forward with their stories in what's being called a second Me Too wave. It was set off by a book implicating an influential Parisian intellectual in an abusive relationship with his stepson. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports that many hope the public reckoning will lead to much needed changes.
La Familia Grande has hit France like a bomb. Within its 200 pages, 45-year-old lawyer Camille Kouchner reveals what she says was a long-kept family secret, that her stepfather, well-known political scientist and media pundit Olivier Duhamel, regularly crept into her twin brother's bedroom at night. Kouchner spoke about it in a television interview last month.
I remember hiding it from my friends, of being happy and laughing with them, and at the same time, having a sort of stone in my heart. I was 14 and not sexually aware yet. So while I didn't really understand, I knew it was something very bad.
Duhamel has not responded to the allegations. Kouchner's book triggered some 80,000 testimonials on the internet in just a couple days. The outpouring wasn't limited to social media. Bruno Kestrel is a parliamentarian with President Emmanuel Macron's party. He told French TV that he was raped at 11 by a neighbor who was like a family member, and said Kouchner's book had helped him talk about it. Yes, this happened to me. It could happen to anybody, he said. But look where I am today. You have to go on living and fighting. Specialists say the harrowing accounts are traumatizing for society and underscore the need for better protections for minors in France. A clearly stunned President Emmanuel Macron promised change in a video shared on Twitter. Macron spoke of lives shattered in the supposed safety of childhood bedrooms and on family vacations. It is time for shame to change sides, he said. We hear you and we believe you.
On vous écoute. On vous croit.
I think what is happening in France right now is very important. It means that collectively, France is now at a turning point. We cannot continue to ignore the scale of the problem.
That's Patrick Loiseleur, vice president of an organization that helps incest survivors. He estimates that 10% of the French have been victims of incest, partly because the justice system lacks the legal tools to prosecute and sentence pedo-criminals. For one thing, says Loiseleur, France has no minimum age of consent.
In France, the law still considers that a child is pretty much like an adult, and the law about rape is pretty much the same for children and adults.
Meaning a child, like an adult, has to show constraint, violence, threat, or surprise to prove rape. Loiseleur says it's no longer possible to hear that a 10-year-old was consenting in a sexual relationship with an adult.
Journaliste, politologue, Olivier Duhamel.
Once a frequent contributor on radio and TV talk shows like this one, Duhamel has resigned from his media platforms and his position as director of Paris's prestigious Sciences Po University. Incest takes place everywhere and in every milieu, says psychiatrist and victims advocate Muriel Salmona. But there's something particular in France.
There's been a sort of propaganda of normalization of this violence and behavior when it's perpetuated by elites in literature or the arts. It's like they get a moral pass. They're uninhibited, talking about sexual freedom, even laughing and bragging about exploiting children.
The revelations over incest are just the latest in a broader reckoning over sex, gender, and power in France that is shaking the spheres of politics and culture.
À quel âge ça a commencé? Y a-t-il eu consentement? Y a-t-il eu ou non?
When prominent intellectual commentator Alain Finkielkraut waxed on in a recent television talk show about how it was important to know if the 14-year-old Kushner boy had consented with his stepfather, the pundit lost his job amidst a cascade of outrage. Victims advocate Salmona says for the first time there is total unity on the issue, including from the media. She hopes France will soon fix a minimum age of consent and scrap any statute of limitations for incest and sex crimes against minors. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
My name is Peter Sagal, and I'm here to interrupt your very serious NPR podcast to tell you about another NPR podcast, mainly mine, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Chances are that right now you're enjoying an earnest, serious treatment of some serious topic in the news or perhaps history or science. That's great, really. Well, that's not what we do, because people cannot live on serious alone. Listen now to the Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.
The World Health Organization's team of coronavirus investigators is out with initial insights from Wuhan, China today, after a month of probing the origins of the pandemic. Here's the head of the team, Dr. Peter Ben Imbarek.
Did we change dramatically the picture we had beforehand? I don't think so. Did we improve our understanding? Did we add details to that story? Absolutely.
The BBC's Stephen McDonald is also in Wuhan. And Stephen, tell us more about what the WHO said.
Well, what they did is they looked at four theories. Number one, that the coronavirus has come from one species of animal, jumped into human beings. Number two, that it has traveled from one type of animal into an intermediary animal species, then human beings. Number three, that it's come off a frozen surface, say, frozen seafood into human beings. Number four, that it's as a result of lab leaks. Now, on that last one, they're saying they can't find any evidence of a lab leak. And what's more, they're saying they couldn't find a single lab anywhere in the world which is looking at this particular type of coronavirus. So really, people shouldn't be spending effort, money, time on that theory. Forget it. They like number two, though. They think most likely is animal, human being. And so that's where most of the effort should now go.
Well, let's break down some of those other conclusions. You mentioned that the lead investigator said the transmission through the trade in frozen food products was a possibility. What exactly does that mean?
Well, what they really want is more research on this, because they've now found out that the virus can survive much longer than we thought on frozen surfaces, like, say, a frozen fish. For that reason, it can be transported over much greater distances than we believed and still survive on that frozen surface. What they don't know, though, is at the other end, if it can then infect someone. Now, the Chinese government likes this theory because it could mean that the coronavirus came from overseas at some point, and that it's been transported to Wuhan, although this is where the first outbreak was. But again, right, much more work needs to be done on this. And it's all sort of bound up in this report that these scientists are now putting together as they, the final report will be presented in Geneva. Right now, they're packing up their bags and getting ready to leave Wuhan tomorrow.
Mm. And as you said, I mean, this is super political. I mean, China has faced a lot of questions about whether it suppressed information about this pandemic in the early days. Is there any sense at the end of this investigation, you mentioned that they'll be sending their results out, that there's really a better understanding of how this pandemic began and whether we might be more prepared for another one?
Well, they claim there is. Not saying they've obviously really close to finding the origins of the coronavirus, but they claim a lot has been done on this trip. One thing they're saying, for example, is they still can't pin down how the coronavirus got into that seafood market, because it could have been a frozen animal. But they would argue, they said today, that they've made a pretty good inroad into at least heading in the direction of finding the original source of the coronavirus.
That's the BBC's Stephen McDonnell in Wuhan, China. Thank you so much.
Great to talk to you.
Actress Nicole Beharie has been getting a lot of love for her stunning performance in the film Miss Juneteenth. She recently won a Gotham Award, the Hollywood Critics Association Game Changer Award, and she's been nominated for an Independent Spirit Award. Juneteenth, or June 19th, marks the day in 1865 when the enslaved people of Texas were informed they were free, 2 years after Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation formally abolished slavery. Many Black American communities celebrate the day, often with Miss Juneteenth beauty pageants. One of those pageants is the subject of Miss Juneteenth, and Nicole Beharie stars as Turquoise, a former Miss Juneteenth winner.
When I was a kid, I used to go to the pageant every year, dreaming that one day I'd be up there. And the girls that won looked like they were floating. And they had all this hope and promise. I felt that when I won.
But for Turquoise, that promise went unfulfilled, and she hopes her daughter Kai can win this year's pageant and take advantage of the opportunities that come with the crown. Miss Juneteenth was released on Juneteenth last year, and that day last year got widespread attention as people throughout the country protested against police brutality and racism. And Nicole Beharie joined me then via Skype. Nicole, what a moment that we're in right now, and what a moment for this film to be released.
Yeah, it's surreal. I couldn't have imagined shooting this a year ago and really just becoming familiar with the holiday, Juneteenth. I had planned on celebrating this year for the first time, but now it brings on a whole nother meaning.
What does this day represent for you?
It's a bittersweet holiday, and it kind of parallels with the story that we're telling, you know, sort of a dream deferred. We're celebrating freedom, but it's freedom that's been delayed. I feel like that's really pretty resonant with the moment that we're in right now.
Yeah, it speaks to Juneteenth in that this celebration came 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, and also the complexity of American history that's often left out, which is another thing that I like about
the film that we made is that, like, all the characters are flawed and they're well-meaning and there's space to sort of see things from a lot of different perspectives. I think that also speaks to just like the complexity of this moment. Like, nobody is completely right. Nobody is completely wrong. I usually start work with like a question, and being turquoise, like, so much is uncertain and so much of your life is in flux that I feel like a year ago, I could not have imagined how much people I think will relate to that now. You know, people don't know what's going to happen financially, with their health, with their futures, the future of their children. And that's really where we find this character.
Let's talk a little bit more about the character. So both your character, Turquoise, and her daughter in the film are so familiar to me. I mean, I was in a few pageants and cotillions as a young adult.
Really?
I know. Yeah. Cotillions. I mean, man. I mean, it really spoke to me, that idea of looking at the debutantes and thinking about your future. I remember being really young and I'd go to these cotillions. My cousins were in them. And just the hope and the promise of the future, you know? As part of the prize in this film, Miss Juneteenth gets a scholarship to a historically Black college, which means everything for your character, Turquoise. Let's listen.
That scholarship made me feel like I finally had a chance. My life could have been different if I would have stuck with it. That's what I want for you.
You lived this character during the filming. What does the pageant represent for you?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Wow. I have a complex relationship with pageants. I probably shouldn't say this. I've never been in one myself. You know, I was like a theater kid, nerd, weird person. So they probably wouldn't have wanted me anyway in anybody's pageant. But I kind of see the pageant in this as like one of the doors of opportunity. And Turquoise is really stubborn about wanting her daughter to walk through that particular door. A little bit of the pageant to me is holding on to the past, and because it was so personal to her, because she had won. And like, how many of us feel like our best days are behind us, especially as a woman, an actress that's getting older? That's another one of the questions that I've been asking myself, and probably
really?
Through this.
Yeah.
Through this film is like, are your best days behind you? What does that feel like? And how does that change the way that you move in the world? And I think Turquoise believes that at the beginning of this film.
Writer, director, Channing Godfrey Peoples. She set this film in Fort Worth, Texas, where she grew up as a child of a single mother. How much did her memories shape your performance?
Oh my goodness, even what you're playing, that speech that Turquoise gives to Kai, those words that she's saying are almost verbatim out of, you know, Channing's mouth.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. Like, I got there and, you know, she's from this community in Fort Worth, Texas. And they were, I mean, a real community. Like, everyone rallied around. A lot of the actors are actually locals and people that frequent all the bars and the church and the pageant. So it was 100% her baby. And with that came, like, you know, go hang out with my cousins and work on your dialect, you know, and
work
in the bar. Yeah, I like worked in the bar for like, you know, a few weeks, maybe a week or two.
Yeah. You mentioned for Turquoise, this pageant represents looking to the past. Do you still feel like there's a place for beauty pageants like this? And what do they represent in this current moment?
I've been reading this like traditional West African spiritual teacher named Maladoma Somme, and he talks about the need for ritual and for rites of passage for youth. And something like this, where you're bringing the teenage girl or boy or whomever into the awareness of what the values are and how much the community values them. I do think that there's something there. Does it have to be in the format of putting a dress on and winning a prize? I don't know, but I definitely feel like there's something there that I wish that I had even had. Seeing the confidence and the sort of well-spoken poise of some of these young ladies.
You went to Juilliard you also appeared in Shame, The Express, and TV shows like Sleepy Hollow. I know you from Black Mirror. There's a lot of talk lately about not only diversity in Hollywood, but a centering of Black and Brown narratives and leadership roles in particular. Are you thinking about this in this moment that we're in?
Absolutely. What's interesting is we're seeing people, you know, social media is kind of taking over and we're seeing all kinds of content and people not having to wait for the usual gatekeepers to do things. And I think even during the coronavirus, it kind of leveled the fields. You start thinking of like how you can create outside of what you thought was possible, which kind of harkens back to the story, like reimagining what is storytelling now and who says that a story that's simple. Like I've had a lot of people say about Miss Juneteenth, it's just so simple. I was like waiting for some big kaboom or something to happen. I think there are particular tropes and stereotypes whenever there are people of color or Black people on camera. So yeah, even some of the parts that you talked about, like, you know, leaning into some of the taboos and just creating material that's coloring outside the lines of what we tend to see.
Yeah. Do you think this is a moment of real change?
This might sound a little cynical, but Hollywood has a legacy of supporting stereotypes internationally. You know what I mean? You have master storytellers that are controlling the narratives, and could they potentially manipulate and continue to control them in ways that serve an old paradigm? I don't know, perhaps. Yeah. I hope that changes. But to sort of bring it back to the movie, when you have communities like this or ritual or elders that sort of look back and you have like evidence of the strength of the people and their love and hope for the future generations, then those other storytellers who may not have your best interest in mind have less power.
What do you hope audiences take away from Miss Juneteenth?
That there's an opportunity to like reimagine ourselves when our life shows up a little differently than what we expected it to be. That like our best days are not behind us if we make it so. It's going to take some work, but hopefully, hopefully.
Miss Juneteenth star Nicole Beharie is an Independent Spirit Award nominee, and this film is available on Amazon Prime and other streaming services.
On his first day in office, President Biden rescinded a Trump-era travel ban that severely restricted the number of immigrants from several majority Muslim countries. Immigration advocates applauded the move, but there are still thousands of people waiting to be reunited with their family members in the U.S. Carmel Dalshad from member station WAMU reports.
Dana Harvey's love story with her fiancé began with a trip to Lebanon in early 2016. The 38-year-old Syrian-American optometrist flew to the country to provide aid to Syrian refugees. It's there she met Mishal Hammoud, the Syrian field coordinator for an NGO in the camps. They kept in touch after she came back to Virginia.
The next several months, our relationship kind of morphed into something more than just kind of work-related.
The couple got engaged in April 2017, months after the Trump administration began to severely tighten immigration from several majority Muslim countries, including Syria, Iran, Yemen, and Sudan. The administration said Trump's executive order was a matter of national security, so Harbi thought they wouldn't be affected.
We had nothing to hide. We still have nothing to hide. We're, you know, just trying to start our lives together under one roof in one country.
The couple applied for a fiancé visa in December 2017 to bring Hammoud to the U.S., and they remained optimistic it'd be approved. But 3 years later, Hammoud is still in Lebanon. The visa application is still pending, and the stress of a long-distance relationship is taking a toll on Harbi.
So I did start seeing a therapist. I was diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and severe stress. And so it's hard.
Harbi says she was relieved after Biden won the presidency and rescinded the travel ban on day one. But even though the travel restrictions have been lifted, there's still 4 years' worth of immigration backlogs the government will have to sort through, and thousands of people who've been kept apart, like Harbi and Hammoud.
And I really can't wait for him to be here, to be given the opportunity to come here, to prove to everyone who prevented him from coming or who was scared. He's only going to make wherever he ends up being a better place.
Harbi hopes Biden's immigration changes will mean she and her fiancé can finally be together permanently in America, and for him to be here for the birth of their first child due in April. If they're not reunited in time, Harbi plans on going to Lebanon after she and the baby are cleared to travel.
Most people have already started or are starting to plan their nurseries and things like that, and I am kind of in limbo because, you know, do I buy a crib if I end up going back to Lebanon and spending 6 months to a year there? Do I really even need to invest in, you know, creating a nursery here?
These are all questions that keep Harbi up at night. And they're ones Madiha Al-Hussein with the civil rights group Muslim Advocates hears all too often.
People have been unable to attend birthdays, graduations, weddings, funerals. This is just the normal milestones or life occasions and events that we tend to want to be at for our family members. The reality for so many people has been that they were not able to do that.
While Al-Hussein applauds Biden's move to rescind the travel ban, she says there's still a lot of work ahead.
Yes, that is no longer law, but countless families have already been impacted by this. So we have to undo what was done. And that doesn't just happen overnight because, you know, there are agencies involved, there are processes involved.
This four-year pileup of work is one reason why Al-Hussein and other immigration advocates are pushing for Congress to pass the No Ban Act, which would bar any future administrations from implementing similarly broad immigration bans.
So that as a country, we don't have to worry about a discriminatory ban like this again, and that people who are going to hopefully be reunited very soon with their families, they're not ever going to have this question lingering, well, will this happen again?
Mona is an Iranian-American who lives in Maryland. She was 3 months pregnant when the travel ban became law in 2017. She declined to give her last name for fear of reprisal, as she now tries to bring her mother to the U.S. She wanted her mother to join her years ago, but says she didn't bother applying, knowing the travel ban was in place.
So all my hopes for her to be with me or I be with her, like, kind of basically was faded away.
So Mona gave birth to her first child without her mother by her side.
It still makes me emotional that I knew that my mom couldn't be with me. Like, it was, I think, hard for both of us.
Mona's father died in Iran last year. She says the separation in his final hours made his loss twice as painful. Mona finally applied for a visa for her mom in January 2020, hoping to get a waiver for her to come to the U.S. Just last month, her application was approved. Mona knows there's still a lot of paperwork to get through before they're reunited. But she's optimistic for the road ahead.
We can't wait for that day to be together again.
She says she can't wait to wrap her arms tight around her mom and feel her embrace.
There are like many days that I said that I just want to stay with my mom, just hug her and like put my head on her legs and sleep. That's the only thing that I want.
For Here and Now, I'm Carmel Dalshad.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.